Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Last night, on Wednesday, August the 22nd, I moderated a town hall meeting for the organization North County Preservation in northern Baltimore County that took place at the Baltimore County Center for Maryland Agriculture on Shawan Road. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss an upcoming vote on zoning issues by the Baltimore County Council, scheduled for Tuesday, August the 28th. So why should the rest of the world care what happens in northern Baltimore County? Well, it's one of the most fertile regions between Virginia and New York that could potentially feed a lot of us in this region. 1.8 million of us and all of Baltimore City survive on its waters for our drinking water, and zoning farmland to housing developments could threaten all of that. Besides, it's land set aside for farms and the environment, a green space for all of us to enjoy. Development should be left to the suburbs and our city. So 3rd District County Councilman Todd Huff will make his zoning decision and present them to the whole county council on August the 28th to vote on it, to resolve what is called the CZMT, or Comprehensive Zoning Map process, done every 4 years. It could change everything, and this is a meeting to hear the people's voices, and we'll share that with you now. Throughout the meeting, you'll hear insight from 5 panelists: Teresa Moore from the Valley's Planning Council, Jim Constable of the Manor Conservancy, Mike Pierce of North County Preservation, Sharon Bailey of the Pretty Boy Watershed Alliance, and Theo LaGarder, the Gunpowder Riverkeeper, and from members of the audience who attended this town meeting. This is Mark Steiner, and we are pleased to be here, that North County Preservation asked us to come here this evening, and that Chris McCollum made this place available here at the Baltimore County Center for Maryland Agriculture on Shawan Road, where we're broadcasting from. This is a live town meeting. In just a few days, it's known as the CZMP, the Comprehensive Zoning Map process, will be done, and Todd Huff will make decisions about what he will recommend to the County Council for Northern Baltimore County, and the Council will vote on it. So this is another way to be heard. So we did ask Todd Huff to join us this evening. I personally asked him, and we had a long conversation. He decided not to come. He doesn't want to talk anymore about the zoning process. He wants to just wait until the 28th when he makes his decision to be heard, and declined to come. And when I spoke with him today, also declined to give a statement on a recorded statement about what he thought, what he wanted to say. He said, I will talk after the 28th. Well, we did have a long talk last Monday, a week ago, and we talked today to his staff members. They thought our conversation was off the record. I thought it was on the record. So we, out of courtesy to him, we're not going to talk about what we talked about till after the 28th. And we'll see what happens then. So that's, once they get that, I'll let you all know that. Let me introduce our panel. Teresa Moore is with us. She's Executive Director of the Valley's Planning Council. And this is celebrating their 50th year. Big part of this conversation will be them. Next to Teresa is Jim Constable, who is President of the Manor Conservancy. Next to Jim is Sharon Bailey with the Pretty Boy Watershed Alliance and the Baltimore County Commission on Environmental Quality. And next to her is Mike Pierce, who is President of North County Preservation. And next to Mike Pierce is Theo LaGarder, who is Gunpowder Riverkeeper. Welcome to have you all here. So let's begin this. I mean, I think that one of the things we know about this region, this area that we live in, is that it is one of the greenest places between Virginia and New York City. Some of the most fertile farmland in that area is right here in Baltimore County, in this part of Baltimore County. We'll explore that, what it means in terms of the zoning process, what people feel needs to happen. We're also going to talk in some greater way about why this is important to people outside of the 3rd Councilmatic District of Baltimore County. Because people can look at this as a very esoteric conversation. As many people would look at it, saving land for a lot of rich people in northern Baltimore County, which is how many people beyond the region of the 3rd District look at it. And we'll talk about that and what the realities are and why this affects more than just the people who may reside here and what it means to develop in this area. So that's how we'll start. And I thought we'd just kind of take a step back, because all this kind of really began in 1962 when a group of people got together to create the plan for this county, and what that led to over the years. That led to a lot of things, even to the smart growth plan of Glenn Denning, to the zoning laws in Baltimore County. It led to a beginning of a process of cooperation between people who lived here, council people, executives, and more, to preserve this area. But rather than I try to kind of get this out, let me turn this over to Teresa Moore to give us a bit of that history and a little background about what that all means.
Thank you. The plan for the Valleys, as Mark said, the Valleys Planning Council is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And in 1962, they commissioned the plan for the Valleys, which was a plan that was done by someone who became a renowned landscape architect, Ian McCarg, and a planner named David Wallace. And they had the idea, which was unusual at the time, to base a plan, a landscape plan, on the ecology. And so they decided where the areas would be best to handle growth and where the areas would be best to preserve. And what they came up with were several recommendations, but the key ones were to limit the provision of public water and sewer as a way of controlling growth, developing resource conservation zoning to protect land, and also to permanently protect land through conservation easements. Everybody here can see the results today. I mean, a lot of things happened over the five decades. The county did a lot. Elected officials did a lot. People did a lot. Community associations. And everybody was taking the big picture view of what the cumulative impacts would be of growth and what would be the best way to handle it. And so today we do have one-third of the county is served by public water and sewer, and two-thirds of the county is zoned for resource conservation. And we also have 60,000 acres under easement, so that's a pretty good track record. And that's a lot to be proud of. Baltimore County is known nationally for its good work in smart growth. And one of the reasons we were able to make that achievement is because we got started early before the sprawl happened. A lot of people ask me how they can get an urban-rural demarcation line, and it's a little late for some places. It had to go in early. And the one thing that we're, you know, people say, well, you've done so much, you can kind of relax now, and that isn't really the case. Most of our waters are still impaired. Our reservoir system that, you know, serves 1.8 million people has a lot of issues, salt being one of them. And we have a lot more to do. The state is on a pollution diet that's mandated by the federal government. We have a new septics bill, and really what we have to do is improve on what's already out there. We can't just not create any more pollution. We have to undo some of what we did wrong to start with. So we do have our work cut out for us, and we do have to do more, even though we've already done a pretty good job.
And let me just let you all just jump in, and don't forget there's a mic there. We really want you to use that mic. You hear something that motivates you to jump up, I want you to jump up and say what you have to say. And if there's a new issue you want to raise that we're not even touching on, I want you to please go up to that mic and raise those issues so that we can all wrestle with them together here. And part of the thing is, I think we should just talk about right up front here, is that this CZMP process will be done on the 28th. The council will vote on it. The council usually always votes the way the district council person suggests that they all vote. Probably no matter what we say here today, it will have very little effect on what happens on the 28th. But the question is why it's important and what we think we're facing now and why people on this panel and people who actually call this meeting think that it's important to get this out on the table today.
So. Building on what was just said and speaking in my capacity as appointment to the Commission on Environmental Quality for Baltimore County and Baltimore County's tradition of excellence in planning, Baltimore County really was, as she said, an early adapter in smart growth, and they were practicing smart growth long before that term was coined, and in other circles, we really were an early adapter in that. And when the URDL was established in 1967, and since that time, today, 87% of the county's population lives within the URDL, and the balance outside in the rural areas. And I think that level of continuity in planning is really unprecedented in other metropolitan areas. So for 40 years, we have been consistent in carrying out that original planning idea. So that's why this CZMP, well, like all CZMPs, but this one in particular, is very important to continue that level of continuity. Because of all of the challenges, there are always challenges. But this particular CZMP is especially challenging because we have had someone in the county council who honored that planning idea for three terms in office. And we don't know how this councilman is going to vote. That's why everyone is very concerned.
Jim, go ahead.
I want to jump in and talk a little bit about conservation easements because there is an interlock between them and zoning, and Todd Huff has kind of passed the message to me that there's even more of an interlock than we would think. We always, until about the late 70s, relied on zoning for land preservation. As Teresa mentioned, the community groups led by Valleys Planning worked to get some of the most restrictive rural zoning, RC2 and RC4, in the country, and did a great job. But we all knew that zoning is fickle. Good zoning lasts only as long as a good county councilman who's tuned into our interests lasts, and it can change overnight. And in the late 70s, the Internal Revenue Service offered a tax incentive for people to donate conservation easements, which are really private agreements that last forever in perpetuity between a landowner and a conservation organization to preserve conservation values on land. And where we are in the North County, it's mainly agricultural land and open space. I know that in Teresa's jurisdiction, the Land Preservation Trust started up. In my jurisdiction, we started the Matta Conservancy, and the state has the Maryland Environmental Trust, and they were very, very active. And then since then, there have been programs to purchase rather than just donate development rights, Rural Legacy, Maryland Agricultural Land Preservation Foundation, and then Baltimore County has its own agricultural program to purchase. Unfortunately, they're out of money right now, but that's always a cyclical event. Now, how does this affect zoning? The one way councilmen approach some of these zoning issues, which I don't necessarily agree with, is they look at it and say, well, you know, the landowner wants this upzone to commercial. I know it's in a rural area, but can't you all work out a deal and have covenants and restrictions? That's been mentioned to me any number of times on issues I deal with. And my answer is that's not the right way to approach zoning. Zoning is about good land use planning. It's not about individual landowners and what they want. It's not about people. It's about community and land. And if you approach it as, well, this nice guy, he needs money or he wants to make more money, I think I want to help him, and why don't you agree to something reasonable and have covenants so you contain it to something you can live with. Why doesn't that work? First of all, it sets some very bad zoning precedents, and then there's a domino effect and it gets a lot worse. Secondly, there are enforcement problems on two ends. And one end is that there's always the threat that somebody's going to try to declare that easement invalid, and that starts a legal fight, which costs a lot of money. And who knows, they may win, and then you've got a bad zoning classification on some land right in the middle of a rural area, and that's a problem. It's very hard to undo once it's upzoned. It's very hard to downzone it. The other problem is that if the restrictions are in the zoning regulation, then if there's a violation of the restrictions, you call up the zoning enforcement. And you might have to badger them because they're overworked and probably underpaid, but if you badger them enough, they'll react and help you out. But if you're restrictions are in these private covenants, it means every time there's a violation, the community's got to get together, they got to get a lawyer, they got to file a suit for an injunction, and by the time they're through there, even if they win, it's too late, and they've lost a lot of money. And, you know, the smart businessman who may be violating this zone just says, well, that's the cost of my doing business. I'm willing to pay for a little bit of legal fight just so I can carry on and make a profit. It's a very tough situation, and it seems to be an issue that has come up more and more in this particular zoning cycle. The desire to grant a zoning request and pressure on the community that opposes it to enter into covenants and restrictions, which is not a good thing.
And I'm gonna run our way back to the last thing you just said in a minute, because I think that the power of politics is important to kind of wrestle with here in terms of how decisions are made, which is part of the problem that people think is a systemic problem that we need to come back to, I think, and wrestle with here. But I also want to kind of throw out here, and Theo, let me let you lead off on this, and then we'll get out to the audience here. Why is it important, beyond the boundaries of this northern county, that 1,000 acres or so are, as some people would say, in danger of being upzoned, danger of having their zoning changed from what people look at, what does that mean? We say RC7 to an RC4, whatever that is. We can talk about what those things mean. But why is that a danger, and why should anybody care if they don't live across the street from it?
The short answer, Mark, is impervious surface. When we talk about development pressure on North County, what development interests tend to push is that there's an inherent need for more housing in the North County. The other side of that is that with more development come more roads, typically, more roof lines, and more impervious surface. That is the short answer. And the surface water that we see in Baltimore County in small streams and larger rivers does comprise 100% of the drinking water, as Teresa mentioned, that is inherent in the reservoirs and in the Gunpowder River that provide drinking water for 1.8 million residents, not only of the county, but of the city and the four counties that use this water. So the water is a shared resource that flows through the county, and the county in a preserved state does a good job of keeping this water quality high. That, I think, is the short answer. To be a little longer-winded, and you warned me about this, but I'm going to push it a little bit, and talking about what we've lost since the European settlers landed on the shores of Maryland, we've lost nearly 16,500 miles of cold water habitat statewide. This is not really a fish versus houses issue, but the fish are always good indicators of high water quality. And the high water quality is not something that should be used as a bargaining chip when we're talking about development interests.
Not only is it the water source for 1.8 million people in the Baltimore metropolitan area, but it's the breadbasket of Baltimore County, and the green infrastructure is the lungs of the Baltimore metropolitan area. So for all of those reasons, it matters for the economy and the public health of the entire Baltimore metropolitan area.
Let me just ask this very kind of sticky question that people always wrestle with in this, and that has to do with the question of a property owner's right to develop their land and make money, and a community's right to keep land zoned agricultural or zoned for environmental purposes for public use. And I mean, that is an issue. So parse that out for a minute.
You know, that we fought that battle a long time ago, that zoning is an appropriate thing. Now, if at this point you change the zoning of somebody's property, well, it's why the decision can't be taken lightly. And it's why, those who have to make the decision are in a very tight spot because it is such a serious matter.
Jim, you're going to say what?
I mean, it's been recognized as the police power of the government for the health, safety, comfort, and welfare of the citizens to enact zoning laws to restrict. If you really think about it, if you didn't have zoning, if everybody could put a house on a half an acre, nobody's land would be worth a plugged nickel because you'd flood the market with development lot. Anytime you give somebody an up zone, you may be giving them value, but what you're doing in many cases is reducing the value of the land next door or in the community, and that's a real issue. We argued value and loss of value for years back when we were doing the rural conservation zones. I remember we used to have this argument with Dutch Rupersberger when he was our county councilman. He was a great county councilman, and we were able to show him that really it was fair, and coupled with the ability of landowners to sell development rights and to recoup some value, that sort of mooted the issue. He was quite satisfied, and the community was very satisfied because thousands and thousands of acres belonging to farmers have been preserved at the farmer's desire to pass it on to their kids and so on and so forth, and to pay for farming equipment and buy other farms just by the fact that they could sell the development rights and still own the farm. And I want to add on to where zoning and upzoning could really hurt. The economic development for the state and the county is tremendously important. Having such a green area in the Baltimore metropolitan area is a real asset to attract people that want to live in a green area. That's an economic development reason. They bring their businesses in here. Another reason is we probably have in the North County the highest concentration of acres that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places of any place in the country. That is national recognition of the historic character of these thousands and thousands of acres. We have 10,000 acres of My Lady's Manor. We were the first ones to do it, listed. That is a real asset for the county, for the state, and for the United States citizen. And when you drive around on the weekends and you see the bikers bicycling around, you see hikers, you see drivers enjoying all that, it's a wonderful thing to see. zoning is a very good thing. It's a very profitable thing for everybody. It's not a negative.
Let's open up.
My name is Bob Shaw. I live in the Sparks community. And along with the Goscheny sisters, Karen and Mary Jane Goscheny, and others here in the community and in the audience, we collected 1,500 signatures against the upzoning of the Obrecht property and making them into townhomes. And we collected over 600 signatures against the development of the Fate Farm. If I might go back very briefly, we presented this same issue to Councilman McIntyre 4 years ago, and we had half the amount of signatures, and he basically told us, show me what the community has to say about that, and I will listen to you. And so he collected half the signatures that we have at this zoning issue. He listened to us, and he was against both those issues. Now we're faced with the same fight, and we've collected twice the amount of signatures, brought it to Councilman Huff, and was told that his basic premise is he's for landowners' rights. He took our petitions. He does have them. But on the other hand, he says, if you haven't lived in this area for 25 years, I kind of don't hold that very strongly in terms of the community. And I'm not sure where he went with that, but that's basically the 2 times that I met with him, that's basically what he said. And others have heard the same thing. If the vote does not go our way in 6 days after the community has spoken and Todd Huff has done what he thinks is right for the community, how is it that we can potentially get a referendum so that we're not held ransom by one person who makes a decision on our entire community, and that our voices are heard sometime in the future? I might add that when I listened to Councilman Huff speak at the Broadmead community, and I think it was in October, he did say that Obrecht did give him money for his campaign, and I would remind everybody that he also has a family-run business 1.5 miles down the road from where he wants to develop these townhomes, and one could think, and I don't know for this for a fact, but if there's more cars on the road, of course, his family community is going to profit from this. So to be held ransom like this by one person, I'd like to know how we develop some type of referendum so that our voices can be heard in the future and this doesn't happen again if it doesn't go our way.
I've heard Councilman Huff say on more than one occasion what the gentleman said that he said to him, which is, if you haven't lived here for 25 years, you have no voice, which he said to us, well, he didn't say it to me, he said it to my wife, and said to other people who have talked to him, and I think that's a real issue. And so the question is, then what do you do if certain zoning changes go into place that not only affect people's lives around them, but affect the water, affect the land, affect the future of everybody in the metropolitan region? What is the response?
I think we've seen in the news in the last few months a referendum in the county is virtually impossible because of the percentage of the last vote that has to sign it. In fact, there's an effort to reduce that. So referendums, I think, are pretty much out of the question. I think you also have to remember that simply rezoning a piece of property doesn't do anything. It's when they try to build. And there are other ways that even if something's rezoned that certain building development can be stopped, it can be fought, it can be delayed. You can delay it for 4 years and then try to change the zoning again. When that decision is made, there's, far as I understand, there's just virtually no way to change it, you know, to get anything to be done because it's made and that's it. I guess, in my understanding, the county executive can't even veto these bills.
You've seen referendums in this state over gambling, over every other thing, marriage equality, the Dream Act. You saw it in Baltimore City around changing councilmatic districts to individual councilmatic districts that they did it 3 times and they won after the 3rd time they put in a referendum what majority of citizens wanted in the city. So, I mean, I know it's tough, but getting a referendum is not impossible. No. It's not an impossibility. It just takes organizing effort and people to get enough signatures to push it.
The obvious way, by the time you get a referendum going, if you ever do it, it's time for another election. So, you know, there you go, right there. If you've got a county councilman, and the county councilman's greatest power and probably greatest responsibility of a councilman is in land use planning and zoning. And if he's not doing the job, then take care of it at the next election. The other thing is, during the 4 years, between the 4 years, there is a way to change it. If you can prove there's been a change in circumstances or some sort of a mistake in the change in zoning. Now, to find a mistake, you'd have to find something particularly egregious, but if you uncover something in the process that is highly questionable. I mean, it's possible that you could get it changed in the four-year period.
Madam, please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jane Hall. I also live in Sparks. What I first came up to speak about wasn't really towards this group, so I was trying to figure out how to fit that in. So the guy in front of me kind of made that happen. First of all, for that particular issue, I do believe personally that we could get it changed. We could occupy the county council building, okay? And then that could get some attention that we could then further the, you know, petition a referendum. That's, you know, it's always a possibility here. We're still in America. But for that particular zoning issue, my main concern that I came here tonight to talk about is the traffic and the road issues and being involved with some of the other zoning hearings and appeals of zoning hearings about different things in the area. That's a very critical part of York Road that really just cannot be improved if they build there at all. And the traffic in this area really is an issue, and it's become a quality of life issue for the people that live right here, particularly in the lower part of the North County, but all along York Road. We can affect our zoning here, but that's not going to stop the commuters that come through every day. You basically have to risk your life to pull out of New York Road if you're not at a light in many places, because, you know, or rely on somebody to let you in, but you don't know if everybody's paying attention. So it's sometimes it's a scary thing to drive around at rush hour and to come home. And then on top of that, I appreciate, you know, all the efforts, most efforts of the community associations and the preservation, but on my road, Thornton Mill Road, they consistently pave it narrower and narrower. It's not wide enough for lines now. It used to always be. There used to be a shoulder, but now there's like huge drop-offs. It's just dangerous just to drive home even below the speed limit. And but part of the zoning thing that I became aware of is that the county can approve zoning based on how it affects the county roads. They don't really have to concern themselves with the state roads very much beyond the what I believe are outdated rules on the books or what have you with that. But for like a recent building that was proposed at the mall, everything could go through the county because it was going to be on a county road. It wasn't going to exit onto York Road, even though it was right next to York Road, and all those cars were going to go to York Road. The county doesn't have to consider that. So how I'm going to tie this all back together is I was just wondering how these groups might have to try to do something like that to, as a, another way to get involved in these zoning issues and get the county to think more clearly, but also with the people of the state that are drinking the water and all okay. that stuff. Thanks.
Sure,
and thanks for your show, Mark. You're great.
Thank you. Thank you. So anyone want to respond to that? I mean, anybody who lives out here, that becomes an issue. If you think about more development happening on any of the major arteries coming out, whether it's Falls Road or York Road, and the impossibility of even navigating that is real. And how do zoning issues affect that?
I don't think the county council has to pay any attention to that legally. They don't have to pay any attention to anything. They don't have to pay any attention to the planning board. They don't really have to pay any attention to the Office of Planning and Zoning. They can do whatever they want. There's so many of these zoning issues. We've got one up in the Manor that if granted by Councilman Huff, it would be an absolute unmitigated disaster on the roadways from a safety point of view and from an agricultural point of view for the tractors and things like that. The county council does not have to consider any of that.
They don't have to. They often tell you that that will be taken care of during the development plan review process, and that is an option. But we have used it successfully on a couple of issues. Saying that traffic, you know, there's already failing intersections and that kind of thing, and I think they have been taken into consideration. I think that's the first person I've ever heard who said that, complained that the roads are paved too narrow. I always hear the opposite, that they're grabbing more and more of the shoulder whenever they repave. So consider yourself lucky.
Thank you. I can tie my comment into what we just talked about. My name is Ruth Mascara from Moncton, and I'm a retired senior state planner. And I want to say that the CZMP process is the most flawed land use process planning tool I could possibly imagine. We do not require in this process that there be any criteria. We require criteria in everything else we do, in every other process, if it's landmarks, if it's road establishment. There, we don't have water, we don't have transportation, we don't have density, we don't have schools, we don't have any kind of criteria. the land use zoning process for Baltimore County is done on the whim of one person without regard to the rule of law. And the last time I checked, we're supposed to be doing it that way. So I suggest that we look at the whole process, not throw it out, but look at it so that it can be modified and adjusted so there are criteria that have to be, whether it's planning council, planning board, whoever has input, that should be part of the criteria. Thank you.
That's one of the issues was raised to me by several people in this process, was that one of the systemic problems here is how the decisions are made. But I mean, it almost becomes like a theater where people get up there and say what they have to say, and council people listen or they don't listen, and you turn in your papers and they're read or they're not read, probably not, and because certain council people don't like to read. And so that you kind of you wonder what people have to do in these communities to have their voice heard, to have it make a difference, you know, because that is a process. It is I mean, it's in many councils that Baltimore City does the same thing, where if a councilman's district in his district says I want this, everybody else goes along with it. That's part of this councilmatic courtesy that people have.
Ruth's comments were all very valid, but also what Jim had said earlier, that the county council, this is one of their main powers. This is one of the main things that they do. And to regulate that or restrict that in any way, they're just not motivated to do that. So to impose regulations, to expect them to be a self-regulating body is optimistic.
Sir, please.
I'm Doug Carroll. Ruth said a lot of what I was going to say, but I would add to that even though Baltimore County has very strong zoning, there's no other jurisdiction that changes it or brings it up for change every 4 years. That really should be a 10-year cycle. I attended numerous zoning change meetings when Dale Anderson was making the decisions. And that was quite a while ago, but I've been doing this a long time, and that was a giveaway. This was designed, this four-year cycle, for a county councilman to be able to give away value in order to get reelected. There was never such thing as a downzoning. That was unheard of till Brian, really. And even as late as Jim Smith, as our county councilman, being a devout Catholic, gave three or four Catholic organizations an absolute unjustifiable giveaway, Maryville being the most obvious. But this process has a history of being a giveaway process, and the tables have turned when Brian introduced his 12,000-acre downzoning, which is remarkable. No one has ever accomplished something like that. Being from the 2nd District, if I'd have been in the 3rd District, I would just be ashamed to be in the 3rd District if I were all of you to have let this election happen. How did you let this guy follow Brian McIntyre? I can't believe it. Even us urbanites in the 2nd District picked one of the best county councilmen you could have, and it wasn't difficult. You could have gotten someone good elected, and I hope you will the next time. I would run, except I don't live in the 3rd District anymore. But one quick thing, too. I believe that a suit can be filed if decisions are made due to favoritism in opposition to the planning board's decision, opposition to the planning board's recommendation, opposition to Deprim's recommendation, and you can show favoritism. Todd Huff told me, I don't think he was joking, although I can never tell, that Judge Turnbull's his godfather. I think that's true. I think if you add that to the planning board recommendation, the Deprim's decision, and the fact that the neighbor placed their land into an MET easement based on his present zoning, there's probably a lawsuit there that would at least hold things up a long time. I have also taken a process through the emergency zoning change myself with Trenum Mansion. It was very easy. There was no problem to it. There was no opposition. It didn't cost anything. I didn't have a lawyer. It was immediately passed as an emergency zoning change to make Trenum Mansion an office use. This was years ago, but that process is very simple. So perhaps every one of these decisions that community disagrees with should immediately be brought up again as an emergency zoning decision, which goes before a judge. And all the data, previous data I mentioned, favoritism, planning board recommendation, DEPRM decision would come up in that process. I'm sure Jim would like to handle the case. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tammy Vetter, and this is Michelle Tercel. We both live in northern Baltimore County. This is actually the first meeting I've attended. I don't know about Michelle.
This is the first I've attended.
But we wanted to share our experiences, and we had hoped that Mr. Huff was here because I've talked to him quite a few times, and he was actually at my house a couple weeks ago. But I wanted to share my experiences with you. We live in Tracy's Crossing, which is a development off of Middletown Road on Rockdale. It's about 12 housing sites. And as part of the agreement to develop the area, the farmer who was selling the land to the developer agreed to have a band of forest conservation surrounding the complete community with the road, Rockdale Road, going down the center. Starting in maybe the end of June, July, the farmers started to harvest that forest conservation. They had completed about 90% when they were behind my house, and at that point I thought that they had taken down a tree on my property, which I was very upset about. And these are very large trees. In fact, the tree that I was concerned about, the diameter, was over 30 inches. So those trees are so big you can't even put your arms around them. And they are beautiful oak trees and some other trees as well. Anyway, I called the police. Councilman Huff came out the next day. They put a temporary stop order. The next day, Vince Gardinia at the EPS filed a permanent stop order, but what was found was that when they issued the permit to harvest the forest, that they never looked back at the agreement that was filed in 2004. And so we've lost those trees surrounding the whole development. We've continued to contact the EPS. We've contacted the Sierra Club.
I'm Michelle Tercel. I have been to Vince Gardina's office about 3 weeks ago now to ask him what is going to be done about this situation, because with all the heavy equipment back in there, I mean, they took down several hundreds of trees. Several hundred. Okay? The big machinery that they've used has caused a lot of erosion. Down over the hill there is a stream, so can that be eventually contaminated? The loggers that were in there have made an entire mess of brush. You know, they trimmed off the logs of what they did not want. They left in the woods. They left trees that they cut down they did not want. So are we susceptible this fall or any time for brush fires at this point? And there was nobody in Vince's office when my husband and I stopped in there, and he would not see us. I have contacted Councilman Huff, and his secretary emailed me back and said they're going to check into it and get back to us. I have heard nothing. I also contacted Kevin Kamenet's office. His secretary also emailed me back and said, we're going to forward this to the EPS. That was 2 weeks ago. I have heard nothing. So, yeah, which is Vince Gardina. So where can we go from here at this point?
I think you need to see a lawyer.
That is our next step. We are going to contact
one. Yeah, yeah.
Because the permit that Arthur Tracy got from the county, illegally, because the property behind us is zoned conservation. It backs up to Pretty Boy.
Reservoir.
Right. No, I'm very interested in, please give me your address, because I'd like to go out and see
please.
The site. Because it's in our watershed, and it concerns me very much.
Yes.
You know, those are legally binding documents. I don't know why that happened.
Yes, my husband and I also went to the courthouse and got a copy of the plats. And it's even noted on the plats of that area around our homes, and even down the side of Rockdale Road is all zoned conservation, and it was not to be disturbed. And it was two companies, two different logging companies that came in and just...
Well, I'm really sorry that it happened, and I can understand why people are reluctant to call you back.
The story we just heard epitomizes all the things that people have been talking about over the months about what is potentially about to happen in the whole area. I mean, it's at least 1,000 acres could be rezoned, which means developed. And so the question is, I mean, I want to throw out to everybody here before we go back to the audience is, and I want the audience to chime in with their ideas as well, is describing what, right, everything we've talked about in terms with at all the councilmatic hearings that people have had, what people have said they oppose, that they don't want to see built, the thousands of names that have been on petitions that have been turned in, thousands of names have been turned in saying, this is not the way for us to go in this community. The effect it will have, which we'll talk about in a minute, on the agreements around water, the effect it will have on fish, which people may laugh at and scoff at, but we can talk about that for a minute as well. And the effect that it has on the entire region if you develop these farmlands that people are trying to preserve. So let's again talk about for a second in concrete ways about what will be the effect if this goes through? You know, from all the properties we've talked about, whether they're close to here, like Turnbull and Barney's, or whether they're out further out in the northern part of the county, what difference will it make? What effect will it have if those happen?
Mark, I'd like to start and say that a single tree, can typically, say it's 18 inches in diameter, can take up about 40 gallons of stormwater. That's one tree. And these ladies are talking about hundreds of trees. I had a similar experience with the county last year related to an agricultural conservation easement that was not in compliance, and severely not in compliance. And I would suggest that if you feel you've exhausted all of your efforts with the county, to not wait any further for them to get back to you and contact Aaron Fitzsimmons in the Environmental Crimes Unit of the Attorney General's Office and have them contact the county on your behalf and on behalf of the trees.
Right, exactly, because not only are there trees left in the forest that the loggers didn't take and everything, it's also the trees that they damaged that's still standing, that with all their heavy equipment, they actually damaged trees. That what's going
to
happen
now? I think what Theo said is probably one of the smartest things to do, and to, you know, just we all should keep abreast of that and get your name and address and phone number and go out and take a look ourselves and keep following it and putting it out there. I think this is
absolutely
the beginning of that process. But
just to elaborate on what Theo said about the value of trees, what he said about the value, the service of one tree, if you extend that out to the forest cover, ideally in a watershed, we would like to have a forest cover of 51%. But we currently only have 34% forest cover, and we're losing forest cover all the time. The problem with when you allow development, and we're not talking about one or two houses, we're talking about when you upzone from, say, RC2, which only allows one or two houses for every 50 acres, to RC 4 or 5 that allows a real development density. There's the possibility of, if there's forested area on that parcel, you break it up even further. And that's the problem that we've had even over the last three or four decades where we've had this planning, this good planning. In effect, we've seen further breaking up of forest tracts. And when you break up forest tracts, you lose trees, and it's even more difficult to manage those trees and make sure that they're healthy. And we fail to recognize, I think, as a society, the monetary value of these ecosystems, that the value of natural ecosystem services that trees provide. There's carbon sequestration and the water filtration that Theo alluded to, the air quality that they provide, the biohabitat that they provide for animals and fish, even the leaves that oak trees that fall in the stream provide cover and food for fish.
They stabilize the soil and they provide shade. These have real monetary value, and development takes away from that.
Let's go back to the audience, folks.
Hi, Mark. I'm Harold Burns. I want to address property rights. I'm a property owner, and I own a part of a stream. And because of that, I came to learn about riparian rights. When I bought my land, I bought rights that included the rights to that water to continue to flow across my land in the same quality and the same quantity. And that's a common law right that goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. I have that right. And when somebody upstream puts in more than 5% impervious surface, which is not much, RC5 is definitely going to be way over 5% impervious surface. That's going to introduce so much heat into my stream that it'll kill my trout, plainly changing the quality of the water and violating my rights. So I can bring a suit against that property owner upstream who is planning to do something that's going to violate my rights. It may be well within the law of zoning, but it's still going to violate my rights. And theoretically, the court should stop it. And it has, in the past, done that. Actually, for hundreds of years. So that's why we had the wonderful Loch Raven water system, because years back in 1880, when Baltimore City wanted to bring that water over the Timonium ridge line, some guy in Roll and Run, some farmer, sued him and said, no, 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 no. You put all that extra water into Roll and Run, you'll wreck my land. You'll raise the water level, it'll erode the banks, destroy my land. And the Court of Appeals in Maryland said he was right. You can't do it, Baltimore City. Baltimore City had to go further out to get its water system. Give it a try.
I want to come to this question of legality of what could take place in the zoning process that fits into what you're saying in a second. Want to say something quick, Jim?
No, he's right. In riparian rights, the downstream owner has certain rights, and the upstream owner cannot do anything unreasonable. And it's a question of defining unreasonable. And there have been successful cases in that. Actually, I've handled cases like that before and been successful. But let me drop back to the previous ladies who were talking about the trees. You know, we were talking about the danger to trees from just any legitimate development, but the real problem that they were addressing was not the legitimate development, but the failure to abide by restrictions that came with the development. And this is a constant problem. One way to, you know, the quick way, sometimes effective, is just be a real pain in the neck to the enforcers until they finally give up and enforce something because they're so sick of hearing from you. But the other thing to do is try to lobby for better law with stricter penalties. I don't know whether any of you remember about 10 years ago a hedge fund owner who had a huge place down on the Eastern Shore. I know his name, but I better not mention it. His farm manager was instructed to build a pond, and in doing so, he destroyed some wetlands, and he ended up in jail. Another contractor who took trees down in a sacred part along the Potomac outside of Washington, Forest Preserve area, went to jail too. Our penalties are not strong enough. These developers do these things, and it's a cost of doing business. They get their hands slapped, and then they go about doing it again. So that's what we need, stricter penalties.
My name is Rich Kulowick, and I live in Sparks, although not for 25 years, so perhaps I should sit back down. 2 points. First, to follow on what Theo is saying, he takes a keen interest in the river because of his position, so do I. I'm a part-time kayak instructor, and I spend a lot of time in the streams here, so I'm tuned in to what they do. Not only does the destruction of the trees and the forest around us exacerbate the runoff, it also exacerbates drought, removing the capacity of the system to store groundwater. 10 years ago this month, we were in a pretty severe drought. Pretty Boy looked like a puddle. Loch Raven wasn't much better. We're bringing in water from the Susquehanna for 1.8 million people. Today, I checked the level. The gunpowder is running 20 CFS above what it was 10 years ago today, and the only reason it's doing that well is the passing thunderstorms of the past 2 weeks. We are slowly removing our ability to maintain this watershed. If we keep doing this, eventually there are going to be a lot of thirsty people. Second point, more specific to this area, because I know there's been some comments about the possible development along York Road. If you drive up York Road from here, you will find, just in this area, the Fila building, which has been empty for years. You'll find a strip mall in front of it that now has three empty storefronts because it's where businesses go to die. And further up, across from the big water tower at York and is that Loveton Circle, you'll find a huge lot that was clear-cut nearly a decade ago in preparation for office development that never happened because the economy went south. If you cross the road into Loveton Farms, you'll find there's plenty of housing. People can't sell their condos and their townhomes. So it's not like we have a lack of office space. It's not like we have a lack of housing in this area. There isn't a crying need for any of these things, especially at the cost of destruction of more habitat.
And I just throw out here that it's been thrown out before, but people don't pay attention to it. I actually learned it from Ron Seward, who's in the audience, that there are already 500 lots in Baltimore, in this part of Baltimore County, that are zoned for development. 500 already exist. So, Theo, do you want to respond to what you just heard?
I like what I heard. For anyone that's new to this Riverkeeper idea, it actually started some time ago, back on the Hudson, when a group of commercial fishermen found that their right to fish was being impacted by industry. And the gentleman that was up just before, our friend that plies the gunpowder in the kayak, really was pointing more towards a Clean Water Act suit than even a riparian rights suit, because the Clean Water Act is celebrating its 40th year this year. Nixon was known for a lot of good work, but that was one that was quite superb. And the Clean Water Act does give anyone in the U.S. the right to sue based on a diminished right to fishable, swimmable, and drinkable water. As we started, we talked about a shared waters perspective. You know, I'd remind everyone that in the Gunpowder River drainage, we have 53 miles of water, all told, but 217 miles of tribs. It's likely the development would occur along the tribs, not along the main stem, because we have about 2,500 acres of parkland in the upper river that is protected from development because it's owned by the state and it is Gunpowder State Park. As Jimmy was talking about recreational aspects and scenic aspects of keeping the North County less developed, I would also finish by saying that the cold, clean water that we have in the Gunpowder that provides that trout habitat also provides habitat for crabs, for shad, for rockfish down in the tidal Gunpowder that flows into the Chesapeake. So as we're talking about why this is important for other residents, everybody eats crabs, Mark. And if they don't, they should. And they should be clean.
And they should be clean. Sir.
George Harmon, I'm president of the Reisterstown Owings Mills Glendon Coordinating Council. And although we focus on urban issues, we do have the Hanover Road Association as a member, which is very involved in preservation north along Route 30, which is quite possibly the second most traveled commuter route to Pennsylvania in the area. But what I wanted to do is get back to the process issue a little bit about the CZMP process. How do we take the power away from the councilmen? And the councilmen, as was correctly pointed out, are not going to give up their power by changing the process. But one way to do it, and I don't want to get shouted out of the room yet, but there is another process for development, and that is the planned unit development. It does have a hearing component. It does have a decision by an administrative law judge. And it does have the right of appeal to the court system that would allow for public review of the process. But as was pointed out earlier, the big hurdle is getting over the relinquishing of the power of the county council. You need to elect people to the county council that would be willing to entertain a change to the process to allow public involvement. And if you get that public involvement, if you get a negative decision in the hearing officer's decision or administrative law judge decision, you do have some legal recourse. And so I just want everybody to know that there's potential, but it's going to take a concerted effort of all the citizens of the county, because you're going to be dealing with all seven councilmatic districts, and you're almost never going to get them all to make the change. But it would be a great desire of mine to see something like that happen throughout the county. And I think the councilman could possibly do something similar on his own. He could actually defer to such a process within his councilmatic district to help him make the decision. I don't know if that's possible or not either without a lot of challenges and changes to the county code. But I hate to hear people say we can't do it. I think if we all put our minds and hearts to it, there is a possibility of something like that happen. Going back to what everybody's just said in the last two or three speakers, I have over 40 years of experience with state agencies, primarily in water quality issues, having managed at the end the state water quality standards. So I fully understand and commiserate with everybody on their trees and the water quality issues. I just would be happy to help anybody that needs help, and I just offer my services in that regard to any individual or group that might want somebody to work in that area. So I'd like to hear the panel maybe address the primary concern that I stood up here for, and that was trying to change the process again to almost eliminate the CZMP process. If we can't eliminate it, the other gentleman that said every 10 years, maybe every 15 or 20 years might be even more appropriate. But one way or the other, some change must be made, because it's very dangerous to let one person make these long-standing decisions that have literally millions of dollars of value transfer when the zoning goes up or down. And it was correctly pointed out by Mr. Constable, the neighbor's value goes way down if you give high-end upzoning to somebody else adjacent to them. So I'd like to hear some comments from the panel on that, and thank you very much.
Thank you. There's some things I think we should, we have about 20 minutes left, and I want to be able to kind of get some things on the table, and also other people out here in the audience. But one of the things that, in thinking about this evening, and Sharon Billy, I think it was you who said it to me as we were talking about this, was that if certain zoning is changed to allow greater development in Baltimore County, part of Baltimore County, that would affect the water that everyone drinks in Baltimore City, Harford County, Carroll County, and to Howard County. You mentioned that it may in fact be illegal. There may be some other issues that are beyond just zoning. Would you talk to that?
First of all, we're currently involved in something called the Watershed Implementation Program. It stems from a court case. Some of you may have read about it over the past year. Suit was brought in federal court in Virginia against all of the Chesapeake Bay watershed states, saying that enough had not been done to help the health of the Chesapeake Bay. And so as a settlement of that case, all of the Chesapeake Bay watershed states have been required to comply with EPA standards to improve the quality, ultimately the quality of the Chesapeake Bay. And so it's called the watershed diet. Each state, including Maryland, has been handed down standards from the EPA, and the Maryland Department of the Environment, in turn, has handed down requirements to the local governments to formulate plans about how they are going to change their pollution rates that ultimately flow into the bay by 2017. And if we do not meet these standards by 2017, we are going to face very significant fines.
So there is a gentleman that works in the Department of Environmental Protection and Sustainability in charge of water resource protection, who has essentially been working nonstop just on compliance with the watershed implementation plan, trying to get Baltimore County to comply with the federally mandated watershed implementation plan. There have been many meetings with watershed groups and other groups. They're trying to have included in this compliance all of the things that we're already doing for us to get credit for that, so that we don't have to spend a whole lot more of taxpayer money to implement new programs for compliance. And we have this deadline that's only 5 years away. Certainly, greater development in areas where there are tributaries to the gunpowder and the reservoir area that, and the gunpowder eventually comes, it dumps into the Chesapeake Bay, is runs counter to the focus of the watershed implementation plan. Also, we have an agreement with all of the other regional jurisdictions that the reservoirs serve, called the Reservoir Management Agreement, where we agree, all of the jurisdictions agree to implement basically smart growth planning and zoning plans that will protect our resources. So any plans and zoning that runs counter to that is a breach of that agreement. So these are just two examples where we are legally bound to have zoning and land use planning that protects our water and other natural resources. So...
Do you want to add something, Teresa?
I wanted to say something about get a plug for agriculture in while we're sitting in the Maryland Agriculture and Resource Center, and that is that Baltimore County is blessed with good soil. We have class 1, class 2, and class 3 soils, and they're the best for growing crops, and growing food is an important thing. And the new septics bill that the state has passed is another overarching law that we have to come into compliance with, that upzoning would not be consistent with. And if we do things right, most of northern Baltimore County will not be able to have major subdivisions, which means anything 4 houses or more isn't going to fly in this part of the county, because it would be on septics and it's not going to be allowed. So really, we should be doing a little something to get ready for that and comply with that, and it makes sense. And it's just another example of how we could be doing things in concert with the Bay program instead of against it.
Well, I mean, and to wit, I mean, one of the things that I think is disappointing when you talk about the soil and land and about agriculture and the future of agriculture in Baltimore County, whether you're a grain farmer or whether you're one of these new farmers who are have CSAs and working and farming in a different way, the state covered the properties you're talking about. If you look at the Turnbull property, as one of the things that people have talked about, petitions have been signed, that 70% of that site is class 1, 2, and 3 soil. The Barney property is the same, except for the parts that you can't build on because of where it is. The tree farm that people are talking about in Mount Carmel, 81% of that land is rated as top soil. These are issues that don't come up, but they are really important to this conversation, is preserving this. If the future of farming and agriculture and feeding people in America and feeding people in our region comes from preserving land where crops can be grown, it seems to me you're taking the future of our children and the food that they will eat away the more you develop. Because these lands have the potential of being, along with a few other places in Maryland, the breadbasket for an entire region. And I think that's something that doesn't get into this conversation enough. And, And before we move on, there's something else I want to address, then you can please come up here, is the issue of how this kind of zoning may be affected by the septic bill, which is officially called the Sustainable Growth and Agricultural Preservation Act of 2012. But that affects this as well, right? That has not been raised a great deal, at least we haven't heard a lot about it.
All of our reservoirs are polluted and don't meet the standards of the Clean Water Act of 1972. They all have TMDLs, and those need to be cleaned up by the year 2025. They're all polluted by excessive loads of phosphorus, bacteria, and heavy metals. There also is a concern of salt pollution from road salts. Again, further development is not the direction that we should be going in when we live in an area where that is categorized for planning purposes as resource protection, where our drinking water is already polluted.
Sir.
I'm Jay Wright Witcher. I live in Phoenix, and I have 2 points to make. It definitely is clear that there are broader than just CZMP kinds of repercussions and implications of this whole discussion. An example which should be germane here is NiSource, Columbia Gas and Electric's proposal to build a 21-mile, 40-inch gas line from Owings Mills to, Falston. And when you then get into a federal process, and with all due respect to the regulations that may not be being complied with right now, it is also true that for the past at least 2 administrations, probably more, enforcement of those violations has been almost entirely absent. So now we have a federal project coming through that proposes to take along a 21-mile easement, additional 75-foot easements for construction, much of it through untouched older-growth forest that they are going to clear-cut and bring all through. These are like right, they're going to go underneath the Gunpowder River if the proposal gets approved. So there are broader implications, and it's something that I think we should all take to heart when we go to the polls and when we write to our elected representatives. The second point I want to make, not to belabor anything, is back on the CZMP process. I think we need to recognize that the impunity that we all seem to be concerned about here, with which a decision can be made without participation, without hearing the voice of the public, is also characterized, not infrequently, by what I would say are inappropriate relationships between the elected official and some of the petitioners. We have 179... We have a proposal where I live along Stockton Road in Cooper, just south of the manor, where a 179-acre parcel has been proposed by Cunningham Kitchens, a subsidiary of Sinclair Broadcasting, David Smith's company, to be upzoned from RC2, where it has been a family farm forever. They've already purchased the farm from the prior owners, and they privately assure our councilmen that they do not intend to develop it. That instead, what their real goal is to get it to RC4 so that the value that they might derive from it, using my money to pay them, if that's in fact their desire for the development rights, would be higher, and they get a better tax break. Even if that's not true, a one-on-one private chit-chat between a billionaire and a councilman that results in an agreement that the moment that councilman is not going to be reelected is anybody's game. Anybody could happen. The next owner of that house could come in and say, it's RC4. I want a zone development. I want 29 residences on that. And this is a half a mile from Loch Raven. Now, I believe these things should concern us and that they are things that we need to stand up and fight for loudly.
One of the things that Councilman Huff did say to me was, no matter what decisions are made, that he's had assurances from people like Judge Turnbull, who is also his godfather, and the people from Sinclair, that they will, he said those things, that they will not use the new zoning to develop. They just wanted to make more money on their land. So that is fairly consistent in what we've heard. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jen Powers. I am a certified planner, and I'm an environmental planner. And I work out in the field. I work in a very urban county. We are doing a lot with water quality, so I can tell you I've seen what happens when you have too much impervious surface. You have streams that are 10 feet deep because the fire hose of stormwater has run through. So these are costs that those county taxpayers have to pay to mitigate because the development was not done in the first place. It was not done properly. There's a lot of pollution we all have to pay for, and everything that Sharon said was correct about higher costs, pollution abatement, the pollution diet. What I did want to point out about this decision to upzone 400 acres of farmland is that it doesn't bring in as much as it costs. We pay for the infrastructure costs. We pay for road water pollution. We pay for the roads. We pay for the schools. We pay for everything. We subsidize that. So if you want to subsidize that and pay those higher taxes, it's on you. We don't gain from that. We lose quality of life. We lose working lands. We lose working farms and forests. Those farms and forests, they protect us against flooding. They protect us against storms, water quality, air quality. We lose those benefits, and we get a development that increases our taxes. So Todd Huff is affecting your bottom line. This isn't just about bugs and bunnies. It's about your costs. So it's your decision. I'd send an email. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, as the last speaker did, kept it very short and pointed, we ask you all to do that because the hour is growing late. We have to leave here so they can shut up. I mean, shut the place up, not shut you up. Shut the doors, I mean, for the evening. Go ahead.
Wayne McGinnis. I was chairman of the first Ag Land Preservation Group in the county for about 10 years. I have photographs of the county in the 1900. I have aerial photographs in 1950 and aerial photographs today. I can say without reservation, there are many more trees than there ever been in the 100-year history of this county. There are many more deer than I never saw deer growing up. I'm a fourth-generation on our farm. And there are thousands and millions of more people living in this area than there were 100 years ago. So I don't want to hear anybody ever blame the farmers for something that's happening today. Secondly, a little bit about how the planning board works. We just passed a master plan last year that rules the county, should rule zoning. This was completely ignored in some of the cases. For instance, the one the gentleman just talked about on Stockton Road. It's clearly outside of the Erdl line. It's clearly would add 35 more houses. And the planning staff had recommended this. I don't know why. The makeup of the planning board is there's one member from each councilman, which is seven, and they usually listen to the communities, and you have eight members appointed by the county executive. And very often, they are more toward development. And so very often, I propose an upzone or a downzoning. I may only get 1 second on that, and this year we had several cases where I was able to win a number of cases, more than ever did before. But anyway, ours is a recommendation, and like you said, if you went to a 10-year period of between zoning, there is methods to change zoning between, and you'd have 100 battles maybe between a 10-year zoning. So it's not guaranteed there will be no changes in 10 years. And the other thing is, we give away zoning in this county, and the alternative is the transfer of development rights like they use in Montgomery County, where if you want to upzone your property, you would have to buy those rights from someone who was willing to put their land in preservation. So it is all handled privately. So we do have a good system in this county. It's looked at across the country. I have spoken to groups and legislatures in the East Coast, the Midwest, as far west as Colorado. And many of the rest of the country does look for us on what we are doing. We don't have a perfect system, but there's a lot of others out there that are more imperfect. But I would say that in our zoning process, it is true the councilman doesn't have to listen to us, but you put pressure on them, and that's about all the best hope you have. I want to remind you that in the water quality, a lot of these issues sound like they're good recommendations. But I only know one farmer who approves of many of the recommendations they're trying to put through on the farmers. They want me to put a fence on 30 foot on either side. We have about 2 miles of streams on our farm. 4 miles of fencing. I can't keep up the fences that we have, let alone 4 miles and all the invasive species, the multiflora rose, the Cuthadian thistle, and everything else. And where do you think all those deer are going to hang out? So anyway, there are some problems, that's what I'm saying. Sometimes we none of us want to have something that's going to hurt the farmer, but sometimes our good ideas have poor consequences as a result of it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And again, it's 8:30, and we have to shut the building up. So everybody may not be able to get a chance to speak, because we do have to leave the building in a little bit and let them close down. Go ahead.
Very quickly. I just want to say, Judy Waldman, and I've been involved in zoning and CZMP for many, many years, and I have lived here for over 30 years. I believe that sometimes a bad situation provides a silver lining. And I think that in this community, there is a silver lining to what happened in the last councilmanic election. And that is, look at all of you people who are coming forth, who are providing now new, talented, energetic organizations organized together. And you'll see that what you've got just in this room is an amazing amount of possibility for the future and preserving this land and these waters that we hold so dearly. So this is the silver lining. You are the silver lining to what has happened. And I just say, keep it up.
Francis Smith. I live on Belfast Road in Sparks, and I would just like Todd Huff to know that I have an ability to speak. I have lived there for 49 years, and he still doesn't listen, so that's baloney. In any case, I agree with literally everything just about that's been said tonight, but what I really want to focus on, it's only been touched on lightly, is the degradation to the water table and the aquifer. The Sun, just about a month ago, published an article about how the aquifer that serves southern Maryland and the eastern shore, which is literally millions of years old, is beginning to dry up and not get replenished. Well, the same thing is true here. And a new development, I mean, any of you who were here in the drought 10 years ago that the gentleman referred to will know that new wells had to be dug. It lasted 2 years. It was a very difficult situation for all of us. You put another 200, 300, 400 houses on that same water table, and who is going to pay for the water that we will be needing? Thank you.
My name is Paul Dungera. I live in Catonsville in District 1, and I was invited tonight. I'm a community activist and involved in a lot of local land use issues in my district. And I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, when we talk about smart growth and look at the goals of Plan Maryland, focus around urban areas and transit-oriented hubs like Catonsville, like District 1. It's really important to kind of urge our county council to have a process planning that's not steered by the developers. In our area, we have a lot of areas of open space, the Spring Grove State Hospital being one, a large area located on Johnny Cake Road between Johnny Cake and Dogwood, that was previously outside of the IRTL, that they moved the IRTL in 2008 and upzoned from a rural conservation zoning to business major zoning. So a lot of smart growth language is being used at the expense of potentially open space in these already urbanized area. The EPA says that the success of any smart growth program depends upon the commitment of long-term acquisition of open space. And as the high density growth in my district comes, you know, to fruition, open space is going to be more required. And we're here to help District 3. I'm going to help organize with the people that called me here to help lend our soldiers to your soldiers. I hope that can be returned and you can get some feet on the ground in District 1 when we need some help. And I'd like to echo the sentiment of, I think it's a great thing that everybody came out tonight. Thanks.
Thank you.
My name's Glenn Elstrud. I'm president of the Hanover Road Association. My grandchildren are the fifth generation on our farm. I would just like to say that there are a lot of good suggestions, a lot of ideas have been shared here tonight. But I think one effort that's happened in Baltimore County is land preservation has solved a number of those problems. Farms that go into ag preservation have soil conservation plans on them. They have forest plans on all the tree land and the areas that are near the streams and waterlands. On our farms, we've planted thousands of trees along streams and pasture fields for water quality. I think that Ann Jones, Wally Lippincott, Dan Calhoun, some of the folks in our area here, have done an absolutely excellent job in meeting and learning and understanding the farmers and their needs and getting a number of farms in ag preservation. The funding is a little bit short now, and I think that that's something that we should be making our representatives aware of is how important that is to us and moving forward, try to get some of that funding back. The other thing I would say, as members or board of directors of community associations, it's important that you know the people, you know the property owners in your area, so that you can be proactive and hopefully move on some of these properties with buyers and other people that share the same interest that you have, rather than trying to fight a fire once it becomes a tremendous fire. Teresa Moore, George Harmon, Hanover Road Association recently had an incident where Baltimore Gas and Electric was going to build a $100 million substation in some property that was pretty much surrounded by farms and ag preservation. We were successful in relocating that on property that we had feared would perhaps be commercial and sometimes in the future. Of the 180 acres they purchased, two-thirds of it will remain open space in the future and have a covenant agreement. So I think that as community leaders, as people that your members of your community trust in and feel as though you're the leaders, we have responsibilities to be proactive. We should know about these issues. We should find investors that share the same thoughts that we have, and we should move forward to protect the area and not always be fighting the fire once it's out of control. I thank you very much.
Thank you. So let me do this. I think, is there anybody else that had the last thing to say, because we do have to wrap it up? All right. So I want to appreciate everybody coming out tonight. Appreciate everybody coming out tonight. I think there's a lot that was said this evening. My sense is this is just the beginning of a conversation. People all over the county are interested in talking about these issues together. It's good to have them happen here. And I think that one of the things we're saying here, and maybe some of the panel would like to wrap this up, we'd love to that even though the decisions will be made on the 28th, it's not the end of the ballgame. That there's still a lot left to say, and a lot of power and people, like in this room right here, to get done what has to get done, to preserve the lands they want to preserve and preserve the community they want to preserve, which is why all of you showed up. And it was great to see this incredible turnout. Thank the North Baltimore Preservation for putting this together. This was really good of you to do. Thank you for allowing me to do this tonight. Asked me to do it.
That was from a recording we did yesterday, August 22nd, with the North County Preservation at the Baltimore County Center for Maryland Agriculture. And for more information, you can go to northcountypreservation.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews and Clean Cuts for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.